Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Stephen R. Weissman, author of The Chosen Wars, How Judaism Became an American Religion. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden. And we welcome two new young representatives of Israel, our Shinshinyot, Ron Benekot, and Rotem Rappaport. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom, Chag Sameach and Moadim L'Simcha. Today is a minor festival called Hoshana Rabbah, the seventh day of Sukkot, itself the great holiday of Thanksgiving, gratitude, and guests. I hope you've taken some time this week to sit in a sukkah, do the blessings for Lulav and Etrog, and thank God for the beautiful natural world we inhabit and enjoy. This is Zman Simchatenu, the season of our joy, a time to celebrate life. On Sukkot, we eat, drink, invite friends into our sukkahs, and give thanks to God for all that we have. I realize we are now well past Yom Kippur. It ended full 10 days ago, which in this season of breakneck holiday progression seems like a very long time. But I missed playing a classic interpretation of the trademark prayer of the High Holy Days for you, the Unetane Tokev section on Who by Fire and Who by Water, Mi va'esh u'mi va'mayim, as reinterpreted by the remarkable Jewish singer-songwriter, the late Leonard Cohen.
And who by fire, who by water, who in the sunshine, who in the nighttime, who by high ordeal, who by common trial, who in your merry, merry month of May, who by very slow decay, and who shall I say is calling? Lonely slip, who by barbiturate, who in these realms of love, who by something blunt, who by avalanche, who by powder, who for his greed, who for his hunger, and who shall I say is calling? Who in solitude, who in this mirror, who by his latest command, who by his own hand, who in mortal chains, who in power, and who shall I say is calling?
That was Leonard Cohen's version of Who by Fire. By the way, that is far from the only pop or rock song to have borrowed from our liturgy and scripture in this season. Yesterday in Temple, we chanted the great book of Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, from the last part of the Hebrew Bible, the Ketuvim, traditionally read on the Sabbath of Sukkot. And if you don't recall this classic Bird's version of Pete Seeger's setting of a biblical text, quoted way back in 1965, you are missing something great.
A time to heal, a time to
to everything turn.
That song has been used to typify the mid-1960s in many movies, including Forrest Gump. And I've heard that it is the pop song that uses the absolutely earliest text for a lyric ever recorded. According to Jewish tradition, King Solomon wrote the Book of Ecclesiastes. That would be 3,000 years ago. I wonder just where they sent the royalty checks. Of course, King Solomon was royalty. Never mind. Anyway, we are near the conclusion of the long Jewish fall festival season, the solid month filled with holidays, serious and joyous, from Slichot to Rosh Hashanah through Yom Kippur, on to Sukkot, Shmini Atzeret, and finally Simchat Torah. The Jewish calendar month of Tishrei is an embarrassment of riches, and soon we will complete this long fall festival season, put the extreme holiday experience of Judaism behind us. But before that happens, for traditional Jews outside of Israel, tonight and tomorrow are the festival of Shmini Atzeret, the eighth day of assembly for Sukkot, an independent holiday when we say the blessing for rain, Geshem, and lovingly remember our ancestors one more time with Yizkor prayers. And tomorrow night and Tuesday will be Simchat Torah, the celebration of Torah, the wonderful festival when we complete reading the Torah and begin again from Bereishit, Genesis. Reform Jews and all Jews in Israel combine these two festivals into one over-the-top final festive day of the fall, Atzeret Simchat Torah. I have a favorite anecdote to share about Simchat Torah. This particular story goes back to when I was living in Jerusalem, attending Hebrew Union College as a rabbinical student. Having grown up knowing the American version of Simchat Torah as a wide-open, musical, fun festival, on the night of Simchat Torah, my classmates and I went looking for a good party, dancing with the Torah, loud singing, good tunes, and a schnapps or two or three to celebrate. What we discovered is that just is not the way Jerusalemites celebrate Simchat Torah. After wandering the Jewish quarter of the Old City in search of revelry, we found a couple of decent Torah readings, plenty of stately hakafot, Torah processionals, but no real parties. We decided to try the ultra-Orthodox area of Mea Shearim. Again, no parties, no Jews dancing in the streets, none of the festivities we associated with Simchat Torah in America. In fact, it was sedate, downright boring. Finally, having found a bottle or two of Arak liquor along the way, we decided to create our own Simchas Torah celebration. The group of us began singing and dancing in the middle of a quiet intersection at the entrance to Mea Shearim. We worked up enough enthusiasm to begin to attract younger Orthodox Jewish guys and some kids willing to come dance with the Meshuggah American revelers, singing Ki Heim Chayenu and Hoshia Et Amecha Yasi Salayich and other songs, dancing in a big circle, living it up Jewishly. We were finally having a truly good time when we heard a plop on the pavement near us, then another, and we realized that the irritated Jerusalem neighbors living nearby were literally pelting us with fruit, throwing their leftover etrogim, the citrons from the holiday of Sukkot, very valuable for that week, but useless now. They didn't need the etrogs anymore. They were tossing them at the crazy Americans, disturbing their Simchat Torah sleep. That could only happen in Jerusalem, Israel. For a last add on our fall celebrations and on Simchat Torah, here's the song Shalom Rav Leohavei Toratecha, great peace of those who love the Torah, from our house rock band, Avanim.
Shalom Rav Leohavei Toratecha. Shalom Rav. Shalom Rav Ve'eim Amo. Ve'eim Amo. Shalom Rav Ve'eim. Shalva, 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 ne'amin lo tzai. Leman lachai, ereai, adabra, shalom, shalom, ma. Shalom, ra, le'ohavei, toratecha, shalom.
That was Avanim playing Shalom Rav Le'ohavei Toratecha for Simchat Torah, either tonight if you are observing Reform practices, or tomorrow night if you're conservative or Orthodox. Chag Sameach. Our guest this morning, Stephen R. Weissman, has written a new book about an important subject: when did Judaism become an American religion? We'll explore his refreshing look at this question when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
I am delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Stephen R. Weissman has written a new book, The Chosen Wars, How Judaism Became an American Religion, a very interesting and important story, not only for the history of Judaism in America, but for American Judaism today. He is Vice President for Publications and Communications at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Stephen Weissman previously served as a correspondent, editor, and editorial board member of the New York Times. And his book, The Great Tax Wars, How the Income Tax Transformed America, received the Sidney Hillman Award back in 2003. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
So what possessed you to write about the development of American Judaism, which for those of us who are Reformed rabbis, it feels very close to home. But, you know, this is an interesting topic, but not one that automatically jumps out as a bestseller candidate.
Well, I think the first reason is that, as you noted, I worked for the New York Times for many years, and I'm kind of a political reporter by training, and I love the idea of trying to write a kind of political narrative about the rich history of conflicts over beliefs and doctrines and practices in American Jewish history. There's a lot of great scholarship, but I felt I could, you know, bring it to life with storytelling. And the second reason I think that I wanted to write the book is because I think Judaism today is so divided as never before over all these issues. And I wanted to show how these conflicts are rooted in our past, and that if we understand the fact that we have a legacy of conflicts, we can maybe have more confidence about the future. And if I may, I'd like to say there is a third reason I wanted to write this book. I grew up in a secular Reform Jewish household and didn't really learn about Orthodox Judaism or the Oral Law or the Talmud until I was a young adult, when I stayed with a friend at a seminary in Jerusalem, and I was kind of shocked at my ignorance. But the more I learned about tradition in Judaism, the more I actually wanted to know about the brave, I consider brave, Jewish leaders who broke from tradition. What were they thinking? What were they arguing over? And so in the end, my book is kind of a personal story about how to be religious in the modern world.
You know, it's a fascinating story. And really, it begins with Judaism kind of being forced into modernity around 1800, both in Europe and then in America. Tell us just a little bit about, you know, the genesis of that.
Right. That's right. And I think 1800 is kind of the hinge of history, when science, whether geology or paleontology or cosmology, you know, really turned assumptions about the literal truth of the Bible upside down. But the other thing that happened in 1800 is a little more subtle, But you, having studied in your rabbinical studies, are more familiar with it, which is that this great growth of literary criticism of the Bible and the idea that the growing acceptance of the idea that the Bible and even the Torah were written by various different authors, and that the way to reconcile the contradictions and lack of common sense in some cases was to understand the origins of the teachings, and then understand that the stories in the Bible are not to be taken literally, but to be understood as bringing meaning to basic precepts of conduct and how to behave in the modern world, and the discovery of Judaism as an ethical a body of ethical precepts is really the outgrowth of those changes in the 1800s.
We will continue this compelling discussion not only about the history of Judaism, but how it created American Judaism with Stephen R. Weissman, the author of The Chosen Wars, How Judaism Became an American Religion, when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, Boker Tov, Moadim L'Simcha. Chag Sameach. We're almost at the end of the holiday season, and it's been a big period of holidays, of course, but there's also been some politics to talk about. The UN General Assembly met last week. There's always a lot of sparks around that having to do with Israel. Tell us, from an Israeli perspective, I can talk plenty about what I think about the UN, but what do Israelis think about the United Nations?
So first, we grew up studying about the United Nations. We grew up learning about the United Nations, at school. And
I mean, the partition plan is what starts Israel in 1947.
Not only that, but why it's for, not just all the time with the Israeli perspective. Just like, a student who goes to school and wants to know more about the world, and the United Nations, had a very good purpose. And then, obviously, trying to avoid, the next world war, and obviously working on human rights and different issues. And then I came to the United States in 93, and my dad's first cousin, was the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations. And as soon as I went there, as soon as, we met, and I had the pleasure of going with my new wife to the United Nations, for the first time, but this time as a VIP guest and tour and, get to meet people. And I was very surprised that he shared with me that when there was a big celebration once in the United Nations UN delegation, Israeli delegation, and the reason was, we got into a committee. And when I asked him what kind of committee, he said environmental committee. And I said we had no chance to go to a Security Council committee or any other committee. And he explained, the region and the people voting, and we just had no chance. And throughout the year, I was surprised to see the way the United Nations treats Israel unfairly. Not to say Israel is perfect, but when you hear about other countries as Iran and Syria,
North Korea being
in committees, and when you hear the United Nations condemning Israel so many times, and Syria once, and Iran once, just not fair. And it doesn't make sense.
It's fascinating because, of course, the UN was established to create that sense of fairness in the world. And it's true, the Syrian civil war has been among the most brutal events of the 21st century, and you can take it back for centuries before that. Poison gas, Assad mm-hmm. has done all kinds of horrific things. Children murdered.
Hundreds
on both
and thousands,
sides, it's been horrible, mm-hmm. but Assad is a brutal guy. And yet the condemnation from the United Nations has been non-existent, and that does remind us that getting some balance there is just not likely to be achieved anytime soon. All right. Well, happier topics next week. Thanks so much, Amir.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
There has been, I think, a surprising development in the international political world. You know, somehow we are always whipsawed by these changes. Suddenly there's the Arab Spring, and then there's a recurrence of dominance in the Arab world by the same old elites. There's been this rise in ultranationalism, right-wing populism, not sure the right term, in places like Hungary and Poland and even Italy, and you can make a case for Russia, and some people would make a case for the United States. That's a different idea than we thought. You know, we thought this world wasn't going to work that way. Let's maybe explore that and what that means, particularly for the Jewish populations of these countries.
Right. Well, it's an important topic, and I would say there's two things that sometimes merge and sometimes don't. One is just far-right politics, the resurgence of the extreme right, which does seem to be more or less a global phenomenon. And the other thing that is sometimes related, but not always, is tribalism. And the splintering of multi-ethnic nations, or in some cases, empires, into separate tribes or nations or peoples. And the classic examples of this, obviously, are in the wake of World War I, both the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Ottoman Empire splintered into
many countries
of different nationalities. But as we saw with Yugoslavia in the 90s, it didn't splinter into enough countries, because there was further splintering. And even when the Soviet Union fell apart into its constituent republics, it followed the kind of artificial law of the Soviet Constitution regarding republican boundaries and identities. And a lot of the republics, particularly the Russian Federation, are, as the name implies, federations of many different nations. And one way, obviously, of dealing with centrifugal forces that tend to tear a country apart into its constituent microgroups is authoritarianism, limitations on freedom, human rights, freedom of expression, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, et cetera, et cetera. And we've been seeing that in the post-Soviet space for quite some time. We're now starting to see that in various Eastern European countries, as you pointed out, and less well known to most Americans. But I think also China is the People's Republic of China is really an empire of many different nations, some of which are captive. And certain minorities, like the Turkic speaking Uyghurs in northwestern China, who are originally Muslims, are really violently oppressed and deprived of even the most basic human rights. The situation around the world as we look at it is fairly appalling. And the question is, why? Why is this happening more or less simultaneously in so many different places? And obviously, in terms of this show and our audience, how does it affect Jews? And does it affect Israel at all? And all of those questions are ones we'll need to address in future sessions.
And we will start on that next week. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie do, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A Reform rabbi was so compulsive a golfer that once on Yom Kippur he left the house very early and went out for a quick 9 holes alone. An angel who happened to be looking on immediately notified his superiors that a grievous sin was being committed on Yom Kippur. On the 6th hole, God caused a mighty wind to take the ball directly from the tee to the cup. A miraculous shot. The angel was horrified. "He got a hole in one, the rabbi did," he exclaimed. "You call this punishment, Lord?" And God, with a sly smile on Yom Kippur, said, "So, who is he going to tell?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniyot, the young representatives of Israel here at the Weintraub Israel Center, Ron Benekot and Rotem Rapoport. Boker Tov, Chag Sameach. It's been this endless run of holidays.
Yes.
But in Israel, at the end of Sukkot, everybody goes back to school after a nice vacation. You guys were high school seniors a year ago this time, and you were in the process of applying for this Shnat Sheirut, this year of service. But otherwise, you were high school seniors. Tell us a little bit about that experience and what it was like, and what this process of becoming Shin Shiniyot is for you all.
High school senior year was pretty rough because we started the appliance in the beginning of senior year, and we also had senior year, which is a lot of tests, and you know, finishing like during the Bagrut and
yeah, the Bagrut stuff. We should explain about the Bagrut. Not a happy subject, but an important one. In America, we don't really have one qualifying exam. There's SATs, there's AP tests, there's achievement tests, all kinds of other tests. But in Israel, there's Bagrut, right?
And yeah, that's, so we have like...
It's kind of like the finals.
It's like one giant finals for everybody, though. Every high school... Does every high school senior take it? Or only the ones that are going to go on to college?
You,
how does it work?
You take it in different subjects. For example, you have Bagrut in English and Bagrut in math. But this is your final exam.
It's like your final exam of all of your schooling.
Exactly.
Yeah. No pressure.
No.
Not at all.
So, a tough year, senior year, right?
Yeah, we have a lot of tests for the Bagrut, and there's a lot of studying because it's really tough exams, and we also had the appliance for the Shnat Sheirut, which was very long.
The year of service, so it's an elaborate application process. They only send the best. That's why you guys are here, but still, it must be a very difficult and I think stressful interview process too, right?
Yeah, it was pretty stressful, but in the end of it, we really liked it because we could see why we wanted to do this much after doing all those tests.
So a question I want to ask. If you had not gotten this particular assignment, you know, become Shin Shiniyot, traveling half across the world to America, would you then have done some other year of service or would you have done something else?
For me, the choice was either go into this year of service here in the Jewish community or to recruit to the IDF.
Go into the military.
Yeah, right? Go into the right. military. The reason is that I'm really interested in learning about new cultures, and especially my culture was like the Jewish culture, but abroad, which is something totally different than what I knew my whole life. And I knew that I could contribute in Israel as well, but I could do it after my service, and it doesn't have to be after my senior year.
So now that's a pretty interesting thing, Ron, right? You know, like if you hadn't gotten this, you'd now be, you'd have finished basic training. You would be getting assigned to a unit.
My uniforms.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. However, the truth is, and Rotem, you said you would have done some other form of service even if you hadn't gotten this.
Yes.
Why and what do you think you would have done?
It was really important to me at the beginning of 7 years doing any Shnat Sheirut, any year of service. Of course, year of service in the Jewish agency was my dream, but I knew that if I wouldn't be accepted, I would do it somewhere else. I went to a lot of places trying to get accepted, and I had my youth movement, which I knew I could get, but because I got the Jewish agency, it was my top choice, so...
And the truth is, once you guys go back, you're both going into the IDF, correct?
Yes.
Like, isn't that what happens when you go back after your year?
Yes, we're recruiting August, I believe, and I'm recruiting at October.
Right, and it depends when you were born, when you go in?
Yes,
it depends on where you're born and what your job is, like what your part.
Very interesting. We will talk next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. This week we celebrate Simchat Torah, the wonderful festival, completing the reading of Torah, starting all over again at the very beginning. Breishit, the very first Torah portion of the year, presents a unique challenge for every commentator. There is so much to say. Where to begin? Which is, of course, precisely the point. Genesis is the beginning not only of the Torah, but of Judaism and all Western religion, including Christianity and Islam. It starts with the great theological creation of Bereshit and the immortal, eternal words, Bereshit bara Elohim, in the beginning God created. Those words are instantly recognizable, more famous than nearly all phrases in religious literature. But this celebrated commencement is actually a problem. You see, in Hebrew, the word Bereshit actually means at the beginning of, in a grammatical form called smichut, attached. And it must therefore be followed by a noun, always. Yet, here at the very start of the beginning of the holiest and most ancient text in our tradition, it is followed instead by a verb, bara, created. That is, the first two words of the Torah don't agree with each other. There is a grammatical error in the absolutely first place it could occur in the whole Bible, which is, of course, not only our Bible, but the first text for Christianity, Islam, all of Western civilization. What might this mistaken phrase mean? Commentators throughout history have engaged this question. Perhaps it means at the beginning of time God created, or at the beginning of God's creation of the universe God created, or at the beginning of the world God created, and so on. You can come up with your own fix for the grammatical problem. Why don't we just correct it? Well, all traditional associations aside, we've had this Torah text unchanged for at least 2,000 years, as the Dead Sea Scrolls prove. Who are we to change the Torah, and so on? There's a simple explanation that opens up the whole process of studying Torah and being an active Jew in a wonderful way. You see, if the very first words of Genesis require us to think and interact with the text, every passage of Torah must therefore be open to interpretation. That means that we instantly become partners with God in the creation of Torah in every generation. Each of us must create her or his own understanding of the Torah, must make it meaningful to him or herself. Every one of us has to insert ourselves into this incredible book and find our own way. In the spaces between the words, each of us must create our own midrash, our own interpretation of Judaism that will bring meaning and holiness to our lives. It is a remarkable invitation, Bereshit bara Elohim, at the beginning of Torah. God created the process of midrash, and so invited us as partners to think, learn, teach, and embrace our Judaism. That is really what Torah means, interactive learning. Finding God through using the excellent minds we have been given to explore what a great text can mean. Let's try it. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Stephen R. Weissman, author of The Chosen Wars, How Judaism Became an American Religion, will tell us just that. Find out when and why we became Jewish Americans instead of just Jews who lived here. When we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
While President Donald Trump's truculent speech to the UN General Assembly received most of the attention from the press, as did the laughing response of many attendees, Israeli opposition leader and former Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni of the Zionist Union Party met in New York last week with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas during the UN General Assembly meeting. Livni said the purpose of the meeting was to discuss how to prevent security deterioration and how to build hope for the future. The situation in Gaza is obviously stuck in a terrible place, and Livni believes it will only improve through the return of the Palestinian Authority to Gaza, not by legitimizing the fanatical and violent terrorist organization Hamas. At the meeting, Livni told Abbas, "Isolation and unilateral steps against Israel will be a tragedy. They could lead to further deterioration, loss of control, and the end of the two-state solution. Instead of Hamas-Dan, the PA must mobilize for a solution in Gaza. And instead of attacking the U.S., get back to a dialogue with it. The severity of the situation obligates us all to seek ways to bring about calm, without entrenchment of anger and insult." Tzipi Livni lectured Abbas, saying, "You need to get back to a conversation with the United States on the basis of the principle of the two nation states, a demilitarized Palestinian state alongside Israel. And you should do so not because of sanctions and funding cuts, but despite them. even if you have concerns and anger, even if you do not agree to all the conditions. Livni also told Abbas that the opposition in Israel and the majority of the public in Israel support the idea of two nation states, but we will oppose any unilateral move in international forums against Israel. Financing terrorist families and actions in the International Criminal Court in The Hague are unacceptable, cause people to lose their trust while strengthening extremists, and so on. Look, all of that makes sense, but it reflects the views only of the Israeli minority leader, not the actual leader of the government, Bibi Netanyahu, who cannot be expected to advocate actively for a two-state solution anytime soon, even if he pays lip service to the idea. And it also depends on Mahmoud Abbas to act courageously, something he has been loath to do throughout his long tenure as head of Fatah and the Palestinian Authority. Abbas spoke to the UN General Assembly the day after meeting Livni and basically did the opposite of what she advised. He called Israel's rather benign nation-state law racist, said it nullifies any two-state solution. He called on Trump to rescind the recent U.S. embassy move to Jerusalem and to reverse aid cuts to the Palestinians in order to salvage the prospects of peace. Abbas called Israel's occupation of the West Bank colonial. He repeated the falsehood that every day Israel is committing acts of sacrilege against Muslim holy sites, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which happens to sit on the Temple Mount, of course. Abbas denied that Israel has any true borders, hinting at returning to denying Israel's very right to exist. He stated unequivocally that God was on the side of the Palestinian cause. Not much practical reason for hope in all of that, I'm afraid. In England, the continuing distressing saga of the UK Labour Party's embrace of anti-Israel rhetoric bordering on and crossing into anti-Semitism, well, there, Jeremy Corbyn, head of Britain's Labour Party, said that he would immediately recognize a Palestinian state if elected to lead England. In his keynote speech to the fourth day of the party's annual conference last week, Corbyn criticized Israel's ongoing denial of justice and rights to the Palestinian people, and what he called its discriminatory nation-state law before affirming that he, Corbyn, is for a two-state solution to the conflict. And in order to help make that two-state settlement a reality, we will recognize a Palestinian state as soon as we take office, Corbyn said, to loud applause. He also discussed the accusations of anti-Semitism against him and others in the party that have reached a high point in recent months. The Jewish people have suffered a long and terrible history of persecution and genocide, Corbyn said. The row over anti-Semitism has caused immense hurt and anxiety in the Jewish community and great dismay in the Labour Party, but I hope we can work together to draw a line under it. Earlier in the conference, the party passed a motion criticizing Israel and backing a freeze on British arms sales to Israel. The Labour Party criticized Israel's use of force against Palestinian protesters on the border with Gaza, by the way, they were rioters, and called for more British government funding for the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Before enduring votes on the motion, many delegates waved Palestinian flags and chanted Free Palestine. British Labour's Foreign Affairs spokeswoman Emily Thornberry, however, warned on stage at the conference the party must kick out sickening individuals on the fringes of our movement who use our legitimate support for Palestine as a cloak and cover for their despicable hatred of Jewish people, their desire to see Israel destroyed. The Labour Party's National Executive Committee last month approved the full International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, but added an additional clause on Israel allowing freedom of expression in criticizing it. In July, the Labour Party came under fire after its ruling body and leadership endorsed a code of conduct that excluded several of the examples of anti-Semitism in the code, protecting such statements as accusing Jews of being more loyal to Israel than their own country, claiming that Israel's existence is a racist endeavor, applying a double standard on Israel and comparing contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis. Labour Party members apparently felt such definitions would inappropriately chill criticism of Israel. The Labour Party under Corbyn, a hard-left politician who has called Hezbollah and Hamas his friends and is fighting accusations of harboring anti-Semitic sentiments, well, Labour has come under intense scrutiny in the media over anti-Semitic rhetoric by party members. Back in 2016, an inter-parliamentary committee accused Labour of creating a safe space for those with vile attitudes towards Jewish people. In an interview last week with the BBC, Corbyn declined to personally apologize for a series of anti-Semitic incidents within the party. Jeremy Corbyn also said that remarks about him made last month by former British Chief Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks were quite hurtful and quite offensive and beyond offensive. Sachs accurately labeled Corbyn an anti-Semite and called his rhetoric dangerous. He highlighted Jeremy Corbyn's speech from 2013 in which he said Zionists were unable to understand British ways of thinking despite growing up in the country. Lord Sachs said earlier this month that when people hear that kind of language that has been coming out of Labour, that's been brought to the surface among Jeremy Corbyn's earlier speeches, they cannot but feel an existential threat. Anyone who befriends Hamas and Hezbollah, anyone who uses the term Zionist loosely without great care, is in danger of engulfing Britain in the kind of flames of hatred that have reappeared throughout Europe and is massively irresponsible, Rabbi Sachs said. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Stephen R. Weissman's book is called The Chosen Wars, How Judaism Became an American Religion. He is a distinguished journalist and author, longtime correspondent, editor, and editorial board member of the New York Times. His book in 2003, The Great Tax Wars, How the Income Tax Transformed America, received the Sidney Hillman Award. His new book is called The Chosen Wars, and we began to explore at the beginning of the show why 1800 was kind of a linchpin for for all religion, but certainly for Judaism. In addition, Jews began to break out of the ghettos, partly because of Napoleon in Europe, and partly because they could come to this new country, America, which didn't have ghettos or Jewish quarters or Jew streets. Explain a little bit about, you know, the initial Jewish population in the United States and in colonial America even, and how that transformed really rapidly in the 19th century.
Well, thanks again for having me. Of course, the first arrival of Jews as a collection of Jews in the United States or in North America was in the mid-1600s when Jewish refugees from Brazil washed up in New Amsterdam, then called.
The Dutch colony.
The Dutch colony. They weren't exactly welcomed by Peter Stuyvesant, who... But Stuyvesant would manage to be persuaded to welcome them by the Dutch East India or West India Company, because there were a lot of Jewish investors in the Netherlands. From then on, the history of Judaism has been the history of conflicts within Judaism, first between Sephardim and Ashkenazim, but later, especially with the arrival of German Jews in the early 1800s, especially in the 1840s. And although a lot of people think that it was the German Jews that introduced these modern concepts of challenging Orthodoxy, but actually it began... in several places, but especially I tell the story of the fight over the installation of an organ in Charleston, South Carolina.
Right, at KK Beth Elohim, the historic congregation there, right?
It's a beautiful synagogue.
Gorgeous,
there.
Yeah.
And they had a big fire there in the 1830s in Charleston, wiped out much of the downtown, including a lot of churches and the lone synagogue. And when they reopened, the congregants wanted to install an organ to make the church perhaps make the synagogue more like churches. But they also introduced some new variations of traditional doctrines. The biggest one was that they posted the principles of Maimonides going back to the 12th century, they left out the ones about belief in a Messiah returning Jews to Zion and restoring the temple and the resurrection of the dead, because American Jews in South Carolina and increasingly across the country felt that it was time to realize that the Jews had arrived in Zion in the United States. This was their new Zion. This was a huge issue that later led to many more conflicts throughout the 19th century, including eventually a fist fight and brawl in Albany in 1851.
Crucial moment, by the way, and it involves the maybe the most interesting and charismatic and important early American Jewish figure, Isaac Meir Weiss. Tell us about him.
Well, he was, I think, the most consequential rabbi of this whole era, but he engaged in combat on the right and on the left throughout his career. His main goal was one that he basically failed at, but it was a vision of establishing an American Judaism. He wanted a prayer book for all Jews in America, and he wanted a Judaism that unified American Jews. And it was a beautiful vision, but not to be. There were too many antagonists on the left and on the right. But pivotal moment in his career occurred when he went down to Charleston, apparently wanting to the job of being rabbi there. He had been serving in Albany, New York, in upstate New York, and he went down there and attended a debate over this issue of whether there would be a personal Messiah, like a Jesus-like figure, to deliver the Jews back to Zion. And in the middle of the debate, one of the debaters turned to him and said, "Do you believe in the Messiah or not?" And Wise said, "No, I don't." Well, this created ripples throughout the country and got back to Albany pretty quickly. He was fired from the congregation as rabbi. And on Rosh Hashanah Eve, he went to the temple anyway to take the Torah out of the Ark. And the congregation president ran up to him, slapped him down, grabbed the Torah. They battled over the Torah. The whole congregation jumped in a brawl. The police arrived and cleared the synagogue and arrested Wise, took him back to his house. And that changed the course of Jewish history because Wise, although he stayed on in Albany for another year or two, eventually moved to Cincinnati, where he founded all the modern institutions of Reform Judaism.
And we think that rabbi congregation board president relationships are bad now.
Well, you know, I think it was one of the scholars said it was, you know, almost all the synagogues and congregations in those days had the word shalom in
right.
their name. Oh, and there was anything but shalom.
I think we all know that if a congregation is Beit Shalom or Rodef Shalom, it's all about a split off where there was some awful break with the older synagogue. The development of an American Judaism that was focused on Wise's institutions, which of course now we think of as Reform Judaism in America, Reform Judaism being the first major movement in America, it doesn't last long after the Civil War. Tell us why not.
Well, there was a counter-reaction, of course.
I think the story of the Treifa banquet's pretty good too, which you've got.
Yeah, well, that was the turning point, which was the ordination of the first rabbis at Hebrew Union College in the early 1880s, when they held a banquet and invited Jews of all persuasions and all across the spectrum from around the country, and then to the shock and surprise of the Orthodox Jews, they served shellfish and frog's legs. And a couple of rabbis at least stormed out, and it created, I guess, what I call a faux pas heard around the Jewish world. And it was not long after that that two things happened. One was the Pittsburgh platform, which was the apotheosis of
classical reform.
Classical reform Judaism.
And primarily the work of Kaufman Kohler, who is a kind of important figure in your book and, of course, in American Judaism.
Right.
In the interest of full disclosure, my grandfather's teacher and predecessor in that position at Hebrew Union College. But go ahead.
That's so interesting. Well, he was a brilliant
ideologue,
polemicist,
really.
Too. Yeah. But right around that same time, starting in the 1870s, earlier than that, the greatest exponent of traditional Judaism was sort of a frenemy of Isaac Mayer Wise named Isaac Leeser. You're familiar with his work, but most American Jews have never heard of him. But he was a brilliant, prolific writer who is kind of the father of modern Orthodox and, you would say, conservative Judaism. He died after the Civil War, but his legacy lived on with his followers establishing institutions of more traditional conservative Judaism, such as Jewish Theological Seminary, which was established right after the Treifa Banquet and the Pittsburgh Platform. And so by the end of the century, there were really two kind of branches of Judaism. There was, you know, Reform, and then there was a more traditional conservative slash Orthodox. And conservative and Orthodox didn't split into their separate branches until the 20th century, and that will have to be the subject of another book.
And boy, there are so many fascinating topics. The book is called The Chosen Wars, and not only is it important in terms of American Judaism developing its identity and for American Judaism today, but it's incredibly readable and delightful. I want to thank Stephen R. Weissman for a terrific visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about the book and more about you?
Well, I have a website, StephenRWeissman.com, and you can go to Amazon, of course, to find out about the book, and to Simon & Schuster that also tells about the book. But I have a number of appearances I'm making that are listed on my website. And I want to thank you very much for having me, and also for your very kind comments about my book.
It's a pleasure. When we come back, oh, by the way, when you write your next book about the next stage of American Judaism, you're coming back for sure. So
don't hold your breath.
Well, you know, maybe
this
not tomorrow. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Phyllis Volb, the Executive Director of the America-Israel Gap Year Association. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website, Top 10 in America, a Jewish podcast. Our playout this morning is from Ernest Bloch's Sacred Service, Avodat HaKodesh, for Simchat Torah. Torah Adonai Tmima, the Torah of God is pure and perfect. May you have a Chag Sameach, a Moedim L'Simcha, a happy end of the holidays of Sukkot, Shemini Atzeret, and Simchat Torah, and a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.